Okay, so last time, well, what did we talk about last time, since this is the continuation of last time? Last time, you all have notes, so you should, yeah.
But not last class, like last time your lecture.
Yeah, which was, yeah, last, yeah, that's what I call last time. So 1 week ago, what did we talk about? Collective intelligence, social networks,
online communities.
Yes? Blogs? Quickly.
Recommender systems?
No. No, not yet.
Oh, well, you mentioned them at the end.
Aha, I mentioned them. Like it was a teaser for today. Okay, so. I'm getting a bit cold here, just saying. Is that okay with you? Yeah? If not, you just wave. So last time, essentially, we covered systems that are mostly about human-to-human communication among typically communities, more than one-to-one, like texting or stuff like this. So we covered systems that were supporting communities and what I call collective intelligence. But in fact, essentially, they provided a way for people to exchange information or share information. But the information itself was not really processed by the system. So it was more a communication channel for people to talk to each other. And at least originally, social networks, were mostly passive from the computer's perspective. You know, you keep track of who is following whom, so that when a message arrives, you know who to send it to. So that's just the plumbing of the communication system. Now, what we're going to talk about today is what can happen if the system starts looking inside what is being communicated, what can it do if it analyzes, processes, computes on that information to create a more dynamic media. And now these features, which a lot of people these days call AI, but you know that AI these days means computer science, because a lot of the techniques that are used are not really AI techniques. But anyway, so these types of features nowadays are really sort of percolating every piece of software we use. I think if we get back to the roots of this, it does get back to this notion of not only collective intelligence, but what I would call mixed intelligence. So it's not about saying that if we put more people inside a room and they talk to each other, they can do more than each of them, the sum of what each of them would do individually. It's not just about putting together multiple human intelligences mediated by some communication network. It's about what if we combine that with what computers are good at doing that humans are not necessarily good at doing. So can we combine natural and, here I would have put quotes, artificial intelligence to create a sort of mixed intelligence? I honestly don't like the word intelligence, but it's convenient. The word mixed here is an adjective that is being used in a number of areas that touch on HCI. There is the notion of mixed reality, so what has been called augmented reality is also called mixed reality. I don't know if those of you who are taking that class have been given these different terms for mixed and augmented reality. There are subtle differences according to some authors, but it's the idea that you're mixing real and virtual as opposed to doing purely virtual reality with immersion. The term mixed is also used in what's called mixed initiative dialogue, which are systems, mixed initiative dialogues, which are systems where essentially you let the humans do part of a task, and then the humans stop, and then you can have the system try to do a bit, and then give the result to the human. There's an example of this where the mixed initiative dialogue or system is in fact more powerful than the computer system alone and human experts alone. And that's in the area, so you all know the traveling salesman problem?
Yeah. It's an incomplete problem, right?
Yes, so the traveling salesman problem is a traveling salesman who has to go to a number of customers, is driving a car, and since he is paying for the gas for this car, is trying to find the shortest path that goes through each of the customers, one and only one. And there is a variant of this where he also wants to come back to where he started from, which is usually his home, right? So it's an optimization problem. As you mentioned, it's an NP-complete problem. What does this mean?
He has to try every possible solution to discover the best.
Right. So we don't know an algorithm better than trying all the solutions, well, all the paths, and looking at the shortest one. Now, of course, the computer can be much faster at finding the shortest solution by exhaustive search or by some heuristics that don't necessarily guarantee the absolute best solution, but one that is close enough, etc. It can do that for very large networks these days. In the earlier days, of course, the computers were not as powerful. But on top of that, the real problem that people were trying to were needing to solve was not just one traveling salesman, but it's multiple, say, to change a little bit the problem, delivery trucks. Think Amazon. They have a warehouse with all their stuff, and then they have to decide how to take their, I don't know, 10, 50, 100 trucks to go around and deliver all these packages, and they try to optimize not for one truck, but for 100. And suddenly the problem, well, it's still NP-complete, but much, much harder to solve because the combinatorial explosion is an explosion. Now, it turns out that humans are also very good at solving these types of problems, not necessarily in an optimal way, but they have good intuition. And for many years, it was human experts who were deciding on the routes for this fleet of trucks. And in fact, there was work, now this is a number of years back, and of course, power of computer has increased since then. But at that time, a number of years ago, they had shown that human experts were not as good as necessarily computers. But if you let the human experts do an initial solution, and then you let the computer work around that solution, try to improve it. And then you give that back to the human users that then improve it, and you do this mixed initiative dialogue, then the result is better than computers alone or humans alone, right? Now, this is a kind of ideal task in the sense that there is an optimal solution, even if we can't find it, and the problem is well-defined. But I think where you have really an interest in doing this kind of mixed initiative things is when problems are not necessarily well-defined. There's a lot of things that have been done under the name of artificial intelligence are treated as optimization problems, as variants of this traveling salesman. You have a number of movies on Netflix. How do I recommend some movies that you may want to watch? Now, in the real world, you go talk to your friends, and the friends, you know, who has tastes that are similar to yours, and you probably trust those people's opinion better than some people who have different tastes. The friends know you as well, so you can take recommendations from humans. Now, when you try to turn that into a computer algorithm, which is what Netflix is doing, which is what Amazon is doing to recommend what other things you may want to buy, which is what everybody is doing these days for recommending things. There is no equivalent to the shortest route for the traveling salesman because you cannot nobody can rank their preferred movies in an absolute way. You cannot put a number on it. And so we are in a fuzzy kind of space. And so in this context, it's good to combine the human expertise with machine computation power. And the reason that we have all this, I'm probably ahead of myself here with recommender systems, it's the next slide, and then further down crowdsourcing, where we feed computers with this human data, is because we need that data to approach this this cost function that then the system tries to optimize. So before we get to that, recommender system. I mean, there's a pretty long history of recommender systems, long before Amazon and YouTube and all that. But they were based on this concept that you analyze what other users have recommended. You can also look at their browsing history or the history of things they have bought. So there is, in a sense, a combination of objective data. You know, if you have bought something, it probably means something more meaningful or more important than if you just browsed and didn't buy the product. But if you browsed it by opposition as it was in the list of results and you didn't even look at it, it probably also means more interest. So the idea is that you use this data from human recommendations and actions, and then you try to support what's called collaborative filtering and content-based filtering. So collaborative filtering is based on the historical use data of the user's activity. If you've watched action movies before, you probably, well, they assume you will want to watch more action movies. And then there is content-based filtering, which is using similarity between items and similarity between users to try to make recommendations based on things that the system thinks are similar. Now, this is all linked to each other because to know that things are similar, the system does not necessarily know. They don't look at the content of the movies. So they decide that, say, movies are similar if people recommend a certain movie, also recommend this other movie. Now, here we get to a system where the power of the crowd to provide many recommendations. So in all these systems, there is a scale effect that if you do this with only a few recommendations, you're not going to get good results. But the more recommendations you get, the better it will be. Although there is an effect that is never measured, because how many of you, I don't know, watch movies on Netflix or Hulu or in one of the systems? Yeah. So how, not many. Well, because these are the ones you have to pay for, right? So not good. Okay. But how often is the system good at giving you recommendations, do you think?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah, not so good. Half of the time, okay, that's not bad. Yes? No? What about, well, so I'm sure you all watch YouTube videos. Yeah, because that's free. Yeah, got it. So YouTube makes recommendations, right? They show you the next list. So how good is that? Really bad.
When you start in that one field, they keep going like,
yes,
deeper and deeper.
Right.
Direction.
Yeah.
Because if I for research or whatever, I watch one type of video, the only thing they show me is that. Like, they show a little bit of everything else, but like, I would rather have recommendation from everything I've ever watched than, or you know, the last year.
Right.
Than just the last hour.
Right. And so the thing is that all these recommender algorithms, they're both, I would say, you know, mathematically pretty advanced, but also pretty basic and naive. And there's a bunch of parameters that you tweak. you know, how much you take into account the recent stuff versus the long tail of the history of things, etc. But there's also an effect that people, I don't know, because you are educated users, you're not, you know, regular users, but people get influenced by what the system is showing them, right? And so there are more, I mean, a lot of people are, you know, it's easier to pick a thing on the right than to try to figure out, you know, a new query to get other things. And so, yeah?
For example, it depends also on the content, because Netflix uploads their content, Spotify have their library, YouTube is user content, so it can be exploited by users.
So if I'm YouTuber, I didn't get that.
If I'm a YouTuber and I want my video to show in recommended for other people, I can just use tricks like keywords or maybe just have partial content that is related and all the other is...
Well, but the question is, do you do it?
Like for a... No. I'm not a YouTuber, so...
but my point is that the fact that people feel like these are good recommendations... In a sense, there is a kind of Stockholm syndrome. You know the Stockholm syndrome?
Yeah,
right? It's like, oh, string, you sing. It's like, oh, yeah. And you tend to like it, in a sense, more than you should. Now, in that case, you know, the system is basing recommendations on movies based on movies you have watched. Or it's basing recommendations for videos or... products that are in Amazon's online store. But the thing is, there's the dark side of this is that because all this data is collected, it can also be used for recommending other things. So one thing I've noticed, for example, is I get, if I go to a conference, which is somewhere in the world, I didn't get to choose, say New Orleans, since I was at one there in October, suddenly I get a lot of ads about, I want to spend my next vacation in New Orleans. And apparently for the next 5 years, I will want to spend my next vacation in New Orleans because I did one search about New Orleans because I had to go to this conference. So there is then this idea of transferring what the system can sort of infer about you from one domain to other domains.
Isn't the solution kind of just to give it all your information? Like if it knew that you had already gone there, if you saved all your plane tickets in the Amazon YouTube server?
So what you're saying is that I should give more data rather than less. It's like a denial of service attack. You just flood the system with data so it can be worse at it. No, I mean, the thing...
I mean, ultimately, they only get better the more you use them, and then the more you like use them.
Well, but do they get better? That's the thing I would like, because there is this notion that really annoys me, that we keep saying, well, AI is getting better than humans at this, that, and the other thing. But we measure that on one particular thing, and we omit all the rest. We also fail to compare that maybe it has a higher hit rate, but when it misses really badly. And when it comes to recommending you to watch a movie or to buy a ticket to, if it recommends you to buy a ticket to go to a place that, to Australia these days, because you were, is that a good recommendation once you get there and you know you're in the middle of the fires? I don't know. But there are other types of recommendation that can have much more dire consequences. So the notion of the system is good, the system is better, and it's going to get better and better, is it getting better and better, or are we getting more and more influenced by the system? And that would get to the internet bubble, which is another slide down the road. Now, I mentioned that last time, but I'll say it again. Recommender systems are really... critical to the businesses of many companies, and one of them is Netflix. So Netflix, for a number of years, had an annual prize with $1 million prize if you could create a recommender system that was at least 10% more accurate than theirs. Right? So what they did is they gave you a database of 100 million movie ratings. That database was anonymized, and that database was also added noise to it to make sure you couldn't identify people. Now, they give you this database. What they don't give you is what their algorithm is recommending for a particular user in this database, and what they don't tell you, I guess, or they give you a partial database of what people actually watched, right? And so what does it mean to be 10% more accurate than the Netflix recommender system is that Netflix recommends a user a movie. Is this person going to watch this movie or not? If the person watches, the recommendation is accurate. If he or she doesn't, the recommendation is not accurate, right? So can your system make recommendations that are accurate at least 10% more of the time than the one that Netflix originally gave? That was the challenge. Now, they are pretty good at Netflix because it took several years for the best teams in AI and all these fields, data science, to actually beat them. And the first one to beat them was in 2007, where they actually did a mix of over 100 different algorithms to do the final recommendation. And the winner won because their rate was 10.06%. So it was really by a hair that they won the prize. So it's very hard to get better than current recommender systems done by big companies. And you probably all know that Google was originally based on the PageRank algorithm, right? Yes. And you know pretty much this principle of PageRank? No? So PageRank, you give a weight to each page according to how important it is. So all the pages start with the same weight. And then you update the weight by looking at how many pages point to a given page. So if a lot of pages point to your page has a higher weight. It's a bit more subtle than that, but you iterate this algorithm on the network of links between pages and pages themselves, and after a while it sort of stabilizes and you get the page rank. And so when you did a Google query, it would look at all the pages that would match your query, meaning includes the words that you put in your query, basically, and sorted them by this weight. So that was PageRank. But today, PageRank is only one, what Google calls signals, of several hundreds that are used to weigh pages. And a large part of the rest is fueled by user data. Now, do you know that when you get a page of links of response to your Google query, so you get a page of link, right? So you're going to click one of those links, hopefully. Now, normally on the web, when you click a link, the page that has the link does not know or notify its server that you have clicked on that link, right? You click on the link to go to the next page, and it's not supposed to leave a trace. Yes?
Well, no.
No. Now, if you create an HTML page, you put a link in there, right? If you click the link, the server that gave that page does not know that that link was clicked, right? Now, on many sites these days, but in particular Google and other engines, the click is not what it says. And in fact, you can look at it in the inspector or whatever, but the click in the page of results is actually a link back to Google that has the real destination as a parameter at the end, so that Google knows what link you clicked.
It's a tracker.
It's a tracker. Now, you seem blasé about all that. Yeah, well, of course there are trackers everywhere. The thing that I find deceptive is that they show you the URL of the link, and people are used that if you see the URL, it's the link you're clicking. But in fact, no, because behind that, it's a more complicated URL they have that goes through their servers. Now, the whole purpose of this, of course, is to improve their services, because if they know what people click in answer to a given query, and it's always the third link, well, they're probably going to put this link higher up next time. So this is the good side of this collection of information, is to have this feedback loop. But of course, because they also need to know which was the original query, this allows them to create a profile of what a certain user has been searching for. And that's what fuels Google's business model, because they also use this data for advertising, which was not supposed to be part of a search engine, as far as I can tell. And so this user historical data has become a big part of these systems nowadays, even though originally there were different approaches to do recommendations. The point here is that, you know, it's extremely hard to do better than humans at recommendations. And so I think there is again, an interesting question here of how we can measure how much the systems are getting better, how much used we are getting to what they do, and to adapt to them. So the next point I want to talk about is going from a situation where you passively collect information from users to improve recommendations, among other things, to systems where the combination of human and machine is made more explicit. And this is what I put under the term crowdsourcing. So the term crowdsourcing was created by a journalist at Wired in 2006. And it started with work from, PhD students at CMU, at Carnegie Mellon Universities, who invented this game they called the ESP game. And it's a tagging name. So we all know that computers are not really good at doing image recognition. At least we're not very good at doing image recognition. And so they had created this game where you go on a web page, the system shows you an image, and it's showing the same page to two people simultaneously. And each person, each person is asked to enter keywords describing this image. So here we have this picture. It's, you know, pretty dark and hard to see. But I can see that it has a chimney on top of a roof. And essentially, you are asked to enter keywords, but the system will only keep the keywords if they were entered by the two users. So if one of users is entering, you know, crazy words like, you know, statue, which this is not, it's very unlikely that the other will do the same. And so it's a way for the system to easily filter the bad words or the not useful words to and to get a better database. And so they ran this, and it worked extremely well. I mean, it was able to distribute the task of labeling images among a large number of people, and then to have labels for a bunch of images, so that as PhD students, they have to spend the rest of their PhD annotating the images themselves for whatever they were doing. So the notion of crowdsourcing is the idea that you're going to outsource tasks that the computers cannot do or is not good enough at doing to humans. So it's, in a sense, turning the thing around. I mean, usually we use computers to do things we cannot do. Here, we are using humans to do things that computers cannot do. And it works extremely well. And it's also known under the acronym HIT, standing HIT for human intelligence tasks. Now, you can do this for very simple tasks, like here, annotating images. But you can also do it for more complex tasks. So I don't know if you know this site called Foldit. So it's using crowdsourcing to do a task that experts in biology have a hard time doing. And it's predicting the 3D configuration of a protein in space based on its DNA sequence. Now, if I tell you this is the thing you're going to do, you're going to look at me like, I know nothing about biology and about this stuff. So they created a system that allows you to, it's a bit like, you know, a toy game where you can manipulate this molecule, but the system is giving you feedback about things that are just not possible for biological reason. But you can experiment with a bunch of conformations. And so typically they will take a given protein and then let, you know, hundreds or thousands of people play with it and try to find things. And then the system looks at the one that come up more often, and then the biologists kind of look at them and decide if it's a good solution or not. So in a sense, all of this is also typically based on gamification. So gamification is a way to create incentive for users by creating a competition. So, you know, you accumulate points or whatever candy type of thing you want to encourage people to do it again and to do it more. And here, I guess it was a combination of this gamification, the fact that it looked like a task for experts, but that non-experts could, you know, take a shot at, and it worked extremely well. And in fact, there were papers that were published with the results of what the users of the system had found that the researchers hadn't figured out. So this combination of human and computer can be pretty effective. Now, a lot of this crowdsourcing are also known as, well, the people who work on these crowdsourcing platforms are often called Turkers. Have you heard of that term? Yes? Have you been a Turker? No? Okay. So, why is it called a Turker? In the 17th century, maybe 18th, there was a show touring Europe where there was an automaton, a mechanical machine, that was playing chess that was beating everybody. Maybe not the best chess champions, but beating you know, good players. And so it was presented as this mechanical machine. So it was like the computer of the time was better than humans at this task that was seen as sort of the really pinnacle of human intelligence, playing chess. Now, it turns out that it was not really a mechanical machine that was doing that all by itself. There was a guy who was hiding inside the machine, as you can see here. He was a very small guy, and he was very good at chess. And it was called a Turker because the automaton was hidden in this piece here. Of course, you wouldn't see the guy. It was in a box, and the chess game was on top here. And the guy was dressed as Turk. was make it, I guess, more spectacular. And so it's from this mechanical Turk, as it was known, that was touring Europe in the 17th or 18th century, that the term Turker came from. And in fact, Amazon has a service called Amazon Mechanical Turk. I'll get back to this in a second. Yes?
Aren't some kind of referrals in a way Turks?
No. You can go today, now, to one of these services and register to do tasks. Now, the thing is, when you start, you know, you start at the bottom of the ladder, so you're going to be given very simple tasks, and the system constantly monitors how well you're doing. And this original idea from the original image game, ESP game, of having two people, or two or 10 or 100, do the same task, only take the result that is the most frequent, and saying the other ones, you know, are not doing well or are cheating, is used constantly in these platforms to avoid people cheat the system. Now, the thing is that on this platform, and Amazon Mechanical Turk is the most widespread one, you make money. So you register, and every time you carry out a task, you are given, well, if you're lucky, a cent or two. And so it's used extensively for tasks that require little human expertise that can be done easily by a lot of people, but that computers still cannot do. And typically it's about judging things, or it's about, we'll see an example in a moment, about rewriting text to I don't know, fix typos or fix the English or the language, or things with images a lot, etc. Yes?
The Google Maps review system is a Turk system.
The what?
The Google Maps review system. It's like a game in which you get points by reviewing places.
Yes. Yes.
And adding images.
Yes.
So they're making a database out of.
Yes.
For free. You don't get paid.
You don't get paid. So that's great. And that's the thing where, again, I get irked. I spent 2 years at Stanford working with the HCI group there, and that group was doing a lot of stuff on crowdsourcing in general, and Amazon Mechanical Turk is a platform that is used by a lot of researchers in HCI to run large-scale experiments. So when you run an experiment in HCI, you need to find, you know, 20 users. So you go around the lab and you try to get people. After 3 or 4 times, the people say, no, I don't want to do your 1 hour experiment anymore. I'm tired of this. So running the experiment on online means you have access to a large number of participants. You have to pay them, but really nothing. And the problem, of course, is that they're not all going to, do the experiment right, because that's human nature, you know. So you need to figure out, you know, which ones are to ignore and which one to keep. And these platforms are really very good at having the tools to monitor what Turkers are doing and how well they do it. Now it gets paid, but it gets paid very little. There was a documentary recently on French TV that was looking at that. They interviewed people, and the ones who were doing this all day long, and there are people who do this all day long, they were showing, and sometimes it's really heartbreaking. There was a case of this woman who is a single mother. She has a kid who is handicapped. She doesn't have enough money to put him in a specialized institution, so she cannot get a job because she has to be at home to take care of her kid, and her only source of income, pretty much, is being on Mechanical Turk all day and doing this silly task. And on a good day, she makes $10.
$10?
Yes, working a whole day. I mean, you better go in the metro and, you know, ask for money in the metro than doing this. The thing that was even worse, I found in this documentary, is they went to a company that, for which part of the business, like you were mentioning Google, is to use these Turkers to do all sorts of tasks. And they interviewed the CEO of the company, who was one of these, you know, newly graduated Harvard student, I suppose, who was, you know, doing this business and very proud of it. And as soon as they started talking about this part where they were outsourcing this task, it refused to answer, and he cut down the interview. So behind this, there is a form of exploitation, right? because then you're creating a thing where people agree to work, but without really a contract. They don't get to decide how much they get paid, and they have very little control over their situation, in a sense. And so, as I was saying, Mechanical Turk from Amazon, he's a very profitable service for Amazon, because of course, when you put a task on there, you say how much you're willing to pay, but Amazon takes its cut, right? So they present it as a marketplace for work. Isn't that beautiful? And so that was the interface when I did the slide probably a few years ago. I don't know what it looks like today, but you can either make money by working on hits, make very little money by working on this human intelligence task, or you can get results, right? By putting up tasks and saying how much you're willing to pay, and etc. And you have access to a global, on-demand, 24/7 workforce. I mean, isn't that great? Isn't that progress? Funny thing is, when I was there, several times I asked the researchers there, have you ever been a Turker? I mean, they were creating the systems to do better versions of this, but they had themselves never experienced what it is to do this for an hour, much less for a day, much less for a living, right? Now, on Mechanical Turk, the types of tasks you find are very low-level tasks. So they are typically targeted at people who have no expertise, so that anybody can do it. It's presented as, well, you can make money on the side, etc. But this system of crowdsourcing is also being used for expert tasks. So 99 desks and Odesk are two examples. I don't know if they still exist, because these are slides I did a while back, but the principle certainly still exists. So 99 Designs is a website where you can ask professional designers to make a logo for your new company, product, you name it. So you go there, you put the brief describing the requirements for your logo. You can, write whatever you want. And then designers have access to all the calls that are put on the site. They pick the ones they want to work for, so it looks like, it's like a freelance type of work. Then you put in your design, and then you, who proposed the task in the first place, look at everything that has been done by designers. You pick the one you want, and you pay that designer only. Now, people who need to make logos for little money are thrilled by this. Professional designers, less so. Now, you probably have seen that a little company named Adobe has shifted their business model, right? It used to be that you could buy their software for a certain fee, pretty expensive, but okay, it's sophisticated software. And then you could use it as much as you wanted. And then, 6 months later or a year later, they had a new version. You could upgrade for a fee, or you could keep the old version and it would work for a certain time. Typically a long time. and then they shifted to a subscription model, where now you have to pay either by month or by year to have the privilege of keeping using their software. Whether you use it or not, you have to pay. Now, this is one side of the equation. So they ensure a permanent source of income, because professional designers these days, they don't have a choice. If they don't use Photoshop and Illustrator, they're not going to have a business, right? But at the same time, what they want to do, they create this cloud-based system, so you can put your data in their cloud, And what they want to do is actually become this kind of firm, where they will be the middleman between the professionals who can do designs, and not just logos, you know, it can be anything that you do with these tools, and those who need access to them. Which, of course, means they are charging the designers for the tools, they are charging those who are putting up the tasks for the privilege of putting up tasks on their or jobs on their things, and you know, pretty much before you know it, you don't have a choice but having to go through them to get any kind of work done.
Is it working? What is the strategy? I feel like it's now easier to find cracks of the software.
I think my understanding is that this is not yet really deployed, but it's really part, and I talked to people at Adobe, it's really part of the model they had in mind when they did this shift. But I think there's an increasing number of people who are saying, wait a minute, what are we doing here? Right? I don't mind disruptions, but the thing I observe is that very often disruptions in the name of improving the life of a few people is in fact making the life of a lot of others much worse. And all the, I mean, think of Uber drivers, right? Or things of the Deliveroo guys on their bicycles. So their job is driven not by a boss, which can be a good boss or a bad boss, but by an algorithm that will decide you take this ride or you don't take this ride. It's driven by whether their customers are going to be nice enough to give them 5 stars instead of 4. It's driven by the algorithm deciding that if you go out today where it's raining like crazy and it's super dangerous to ride, you're going to get 10% more. And putting people at risk in these conditions. So yeah, a few people can stay home and have their pizza delivered instead of, you know, walking down the block. But at the expense of people having very insecure jobs that they can lose at any time, poorly paid, with no social security, no pension, no nothing. And this side of the equation, if you talk about it, people say, oh, but you know, you're an old fart and things are changing. Yes, things are changing, but do they have to change in this way?
Was it different before? Like, if you are a pizza delivery man, probably you have a boss that exploits you, even if it's a human one.
Well, but if you are in a big company, a big enough company, yeah, there are unions,
yeah, okay, sure.
Right? And there are rights that are protected. It's not just an accident that Uber insists so much that their drivers are not their employees, that they are pretensely self-employed people who have a choice to work for Uber or for Lyft or for this or for that. In fact, they don't. And that there's been this big legal battle to requalify their jobs as employees, because once you have employees, their rights change. And that would put a big burden for a company like Uber. So no, it hasn't been always the case. And in fact, if you look at the history, and especially I would say, Western countries where social rights have changed very much over the past century, we've gone from a model where people were hired by the hour or by the day to a model where people have more rights and have pensions and have medical coverage and etc. And now I feel like we're going the other way around. Now, of course, I have a personal opinion about what's good and bad. Maybe you have a different opinion, but the thing that bothers me is that we don't even talk about it.
Just to go on with this example.
I'm sorry?
Just to go on with this example.
Yeah.
For example, in my country, these kind of jobs, delivering and stuff, most of them are in black market, so you don't even pay taxes. So
yeah.
With these systems, you are paying taxes at least. You have no coverage?
Oh, I mean, there's always worse. That I'll give you that. But you know, you don't have to go. I mean, I don't know where you come from, but there was an article recently showing that, you know, in Paris, these jobs for doing the pizza delivery, there are normally you cannot do this if you are under 18, I believe. And so there are people who are above age who open an account, and then they had younger ones do it for them. And of course, they keep half the money, and they and that happens in Paris. So, you know, human nature is what it is. So every time there's an opportunity for someone to exploit someone else, it will happen. And the question is, do you let it happen and say, eh, tough luck, you know, we'll see, the market will solve it all, or do you try to intervene? Whatever you're doing and whatever you think should be done, at least it should be explicit. And what I dislike about a lot of the side effects of this digital economy is that a lot of things are hidden. The data that's being stolen from you is hidden. All these shifts in the way work is organized are hidden, and they're always presented on their bright side, and we ignore the other ones. That's the part that I'm fighting. Okay, so just to keep going on this route here. So what we've seen was still very basic in a sense. When you have a task that cannot be done by a computer, you go to a computer to have it done by humans. Now, if you want to create more sophisticated mixed intelligence system, if that's what we want to call it, you're going to have to find a way to combine really these tasks as a computing model, in a sense. So there are two examples here, Soylent and Turkit. Turkit I won't have time to talk much about, but it's if you are curious about this, you can go on the website. These were actually Greg Little and Michael Bernstein were two PhD students from MIT at the time where they did this work. And Michael Bernstein here is now faculty at Stanford in the group I was talking about. So Turkit was really a programming language where some of the primitives of the language was to have a task be done by a human. And the problem is you all know what it's like to debug a program, right? You run, it crashes, or it doesn't give the right result, you fix, you rerun, it works better or worse, you fix, etc. Now, if running your program involves having Turkers involved to solve some tasks, this is going to, well, first, potentially take time because the Turkers need to be available, you know, every time you run the program, and it will end up cost money. So in Turkit, they try to make the development of these hybrid programs more efficient in various ways by capturing what the Turkers are doing so that it can be reused automatically in future tests, in future runs of your program, unless you have changed too many things that you really need to get new input from real people. So I think it's a very clever piece of work that really tries to dive into this notion, well, if we're going to have these algorithms that mix human and machine, we need the tools to support that. Soylent, I think, is a super compelling example of what these things can do when they are integrated in an interactive workflow. So Soylent is a system that can shorten, that can do text editing tasks by offloading them to human Turkers. So I think the best thing is to show you the video from Michael. I hope I have sound. So on the website, there will be a link to another video. This one is an interview he did for CSEM. There's also the video of the paper itself, but I think this one is better here.
Sourcing back in about 2009. But I now look back and see it's the first instance of what you might call online work, where technology and computing is just mediating this relationship between people who want to get stuff done and people who are able to do it, which we now see through applications like Uber, which does the same thing with taxis, The idea behind Soylent originally was to say, well, what would it be like to have the kinds of computing applications that you and I use every day infused with the intelligence of the ground? We started with basically the white lab rat of computer applications, which was the word processor. And so what we did was create a plugin for Microsoft Word. That plugin was called Soylent. The simplest thing it could do is just become a copy editor, where you could sort of select some of your text, and the crowd would come in and start suggesting fixes for it, so grammatical errors or lack of clarity. In fact, we found problems with the paper that we wrote about Soylent, using Soylent. If you're writing on a deadline, what we end up doing is allowing the crowd to sort of come in and offer a bunch of opportunities to shorten your text. And rather than just shortening it, we get a bunch of different alternatives and then give you a slider. And as you drag your slider, your text rewrites itself to become shorter or longer anywhere in between. And what I think has happened over the last couple of years, when I read the tea leaves, is that this marketplace that started out with just micro tasks, where it's going to go, it's pushing toward a future where computation really is mediating that future of work. You know, in the future, I may not work just for Google, right? I might work for Google for 5 hours on Monday, go work for Apple for a bit on Tuesday, go jump around, be, you know, like a consultant for Facebook on Thursday and Friday, all through these digital marketplaces, right? I think that's where this is really going to go. We've seen a lot that we can do with, in some sense, generic crowds. And what my group has been thinking about recently a lot is what happens when you stop saying, oh, what can anyone do? And you start asking, what happens if I could draw on demand a video producer, a software engineer, an artist, an opera singer, just when I need them, and, you know, 10 minutes later have a team and guide them through the kinds of things they're trying to do, like to build these sort of flash teams that never before existed. That's the direction I think it's going. To a certain extent, that future is coming regardless of what we do, and we can either let industrial interests and financial interests and corporate interests sort of guide it toward whatever it's going to be, or we can take the bull by the horns and try to paint a future that we think will be empowering to both workers and requesters and so on. Imagine a world in which the computing systems and the applications that you use are not only far smarter than they are today, but as smart as you and I are. And this is not a world that we have to wait 100 years for artificial intelligence to create, but something that you could use tomorrow.
Find out more in this month's Communications EACM.
Okay. What do you think?
It sounds good if there was no hunger in the world.
So Michael Bernstein is I love him. He's one of the smartest guys I've ever met, and he's done things like so. What you saw very briefly in there in Soylent, there is this magic feature that you pick a paragraph in your text, you ship it to this system that puts it in Amazon Turk, and people start rewriting. So for example, you need it shorter. You know, he said the white lab rat of computing is text editing, but the task that he talks about is the stuff we do all the time when we write research articles. It has to fit in 10 pages, so we spend our significant amount of time to shorten things without changing the meaning and all that. And so he had this feature where you offload the paragraph to the crowd, and then they make several suggestions, and they sort them by length. Now, in the system, there's also a validation stage where other Turkers look at what people have rewritten and decide if it's good or not, if it's not changing the meaning, etc. So it's filtered, and then you get this slider where they're sorted by size, so you can go from the shortest suggestion to the longer, you can adjust your text. And it's magical. It's magical. When you see that side of it, it's like, yeah, I buy this immediately. Now, the thing is that for this to happen, you need to have dozens of people who have agreed to work for you for, in a sense, no matter the amount of money, even if it were expensive and you had the means to pay them, it's not a model that scale. I mean, if all the researchers in the world, just researchers, I'm not saying everybody who's writing a text wanted to use this. That once, wow, we don't have enough human beings to do all the, you know, all the work. So the thing that strikes me is that there's a part of the equation that seems to be omitted. And the other side, what he's talking about is this flash crowds, the idea that, oh, in a project, I need someone like this, someone like that, someone like that. Put them together, and then we're going to get work done. That, I don't think that's how human collective work happens, because it's not just having the skills. It's people. And we've seen time and again, you know, when you have two great companies that merge together, it becomes a disaster because there was a different culture of these two companies, so that when you put them together, it just doesn't work. You know, the culture at Apple is very different from the one at Google. And so when you say, you know, I'm going to work 2 days for Google and then 3 days for Apple, I don't think this works. But maybe I'm wrong. So that's why I'm asking you what you thought, because you're the future generation. Your opinion counts more than mine. You know, I'm going extinct soon enough. That I want to know what you want, and if you believe that this is going to happen no matter what, and as it says, since it's going to happen, let's, you know, make it better if we can, or if this is what we want or not. Yes.
You cannot lose a part of identity. I mean, it's kind of part of your identity.
Yes.
Where you work and who are the people you work with. And if you change, like, every day the company and the people, then it's kind of like, I don't know, having like a split mind or something like this.
Yeah, and you're not the person anymore. You are the sum of your skills that you don't even get to decide, that the system decides that you have or not. And yeah, no, absolutely agree. You know, there are already companies where people don't have an office anymore. They come in the morning, and depending on who's here today, you're given sort of a slot in in an open space for the day. So you're not a person anymore. You're a number. You don't have your stuff. You don't have your office with, you know, that you have customized. So it's very dehumanizing, I think. That's. But anyway, I'm putting words in your mouth. Who else wanted to? Yes.
Expanding on that, it assumes that any task any human will be trusted to do can be done in like some tiny finite. Like, you'll be done with your Google work in a day or whatever. So, like, that means that all of your work at Google fits into, like, perfectly hour chunks.
Yeah.
Which is, which works well for computers, but it's not a human. It's like we're projecting computer work onto humans.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe the solution is in between, is changing, but not so often. Many people do freelancer jobs because they like working on a project. And then maybe not staying with the same company, working and changing company, but a project usually is 6 1 year.
Yeah, so it's a different time scale.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Could work on different time scale.
Okay.
Like for me, I think like for several projects, when you begin to work on a project, you have to be familiar with this at first.
Yeah.
And if you form a group like in 10 minutes and you will start discussing, I don't think they have the enough ability to be familiar enough in this project.
Yeah, and so that's the thing, is that it takes time to build human collectives. Okay, other reactions? Now, there's a lot of work that is, in fact, a conference now dedicated to... I'm trying to remember what it's called, but dedicated to these approaches to crowdsourcing and mixing human tasks with computer tasks. So it is a big topic.
People who have not studied, probably they have no choice in the near future when automation will make it a reality, like for many jobs, who has no real...
Well, but I think it's a... Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say that everyone is affected. Also, if you went to uni and you're an engineer or whatever, because the reality nowadays already is too that it's more and more consultant companies and everyone is only doing consultant big companies. They don't want to employ anyone because they want to stay flexible in case there are bad times coming. So
that's true.
I wouldn't agree that it's only low-income people being affected.
Yeah.
The less you're prepared and skilled, and the less choice you have.
I mean, it's becoming quite clear.
Yeah, but it's also true that the automation is making a number of jobs that were seen as high expertise jobs into the lower part of the expertise. And it should be the other way around. There was, yes?
Yeah, I think it's like also, I mean, in the last century, we tried to remove the human from the chain of work.
Yes.
It's like we replaced the human with robots.
Yeah.
And now we're going to replace robots by humans.
Yes. So we're literally becoming slaves to the machine.
Okay.
I agree. That's the part that worries me. Okay, so there's a couple more general comments I wanted to make here. One, of course, we've already touched upon on several occasions, but you know, even if you don't mind that personal data is collected, they are probably more danger than you think about this lack of privacy protection. I mentioned last time when I was talking about the Netflix thing that this challenge was run, there was a group of researchers who took the database that Netflix was making available, which they had, you know, tried to not only anonymize but also add noise to the data to make it even more difficult to track the individuals. And so these researchers, by combining this database, which was anonymized, with the comments that are on the IMDb website, where people leave comments under their names or pseudonym, they were able to identify, I think it was up to 80% of the authors. And so, you know, even if Netflix guarantees you that they're being careful with their data, this is not sufficient, because someone else may have data that, combined with that one, will hinder this protection. As we all know, the data on the web lives forever. This is something that people don't realize. Last time I encouraged you, if you wanted to, you know, be curious about it. Now there's in Europe, thanks to the data protection regulation, the GDPR. I'm always confused between the French acronym and the English one. The RGPD in French, GDPR. There are two things that are guaranteed. One is that you can ask for a service to give you the data they have on you, and they are required by law to do this. So you can do this with you know, any site where you've opened an account. And the second one is what's called the right to forget. Now, the right to forget is a lot more limited. You cannot ask Google to erase from their results forever a pointer to a page that you don't like. It's much more limited than that. My understanding of it, I'm not a lawyer, but you can ask a search engine to remove from their results a page that would appear if someone typed your name as a query, and it shows a page about the fact that maybe you were charged with a certain crime, and then you were later found not guilty. And so you can ask this type of information to disappear. So it's quite limited. Also, there was a recent ruling by the European Court, which made a lot of people angry, which is that this right to forget can be or only applies in one country at a time. So, you know, you can ask google.fr to remove a page that you don't like, but it will still show up in google.com or whatever other country. But there is still progress being done, and I think I was mentioning last time that, in fact, the European regulation have the effect that some companies are applying the similar rules worldwide and not just to Europe. Partly because it would be too complicated for them to apply it differently in different areas of the world. And so we can hope that this kind of rules will become sort of maybe universal, at least more widely applied. The last part about this here on social privacy and security. So there's a whole area. I mean, it's not really part of groupware as such, but there's a whole area that's studying the usability of. So there's a conference called SOUPS. Which is a symposium on usable privacy and security. How do you make not only the technology to ensure privacy, for example, secure, but also to look at the user aspect of things. So it's in this area that they've shown that companies that ask you to change your password every 6 months are really doing themselves a disservice, because in fact studies show that if you're asked to change your password all the time, you're going to lose. You're going to use the less strong password. You're more likely to write it somewhere on a post-it or to hide it, quote, in your contacts somewhere in your phone or something, so very easy to find. And so in fact, by having you change your password more often, you're more at risk. But there's also all this issue, and that's where, to me, it sort of joins with the issues of group use of computers on social hacking, where the best way to find a password nowadays is not to try to crack a database of password; it's just to get it from the person himself or herself. And it's amazing how many people fall for these phishing attacks, where you receive an email that looks like it's from your bank and say, oh, your thing is down and you have to go to this website and enter your password, and people just do it.
There is a cool video on this, probably on YouTube. I can't remember how to search for it. There is this person that goes and interviews people on the street, and out of like 5 questions, they guess their password.
Yeah?
I don't know how it begins, but they try to shift their mind from the fact that they're trying to learn their password.
Yeah.
And just ask random questions, and they'll be like, so your password is this, and they'll be like, you're not putting this online, right?
Yeah. No, but it's but the thing is, this notion of password is not something that is it's not a human-centered concept. Yes.
A really easy thing is going in a public space, offering a free hotspot for the internet, and asking for a registration with email and password. They usually use the same combination they use on other accounts.
Yeah.
And you just get the email and password.
Yeah.
That's why also in the airport, it's not safe to use your real email. They don't really check if you have an account or not. Just use any email. I usually do.
Yeah. So anyway, the thing is that we are very susceptible to these things. In fact, once I almost fell for one of those because it came from my bank after I had done something with my bank. And so it looked like it was part of the flow of the process I was in the midst of with my bank trying to fix a problem. And fortunately, I caught it in time. But they just play on the fact that, if you send enough phishing attacks to enough people, there are enough of them that will fall for it that you'll make money. And when you look at the numbers of the fraud that is done based on this, it's billions and billions of whatever currency you want to use. Now, the other thing I only touched upon a little bit is this notion of a filter bubble, which is a concept by a guy called Eli, I don't know how you pronounce it, Pariser. And it's this idea that because of these recommender systems, which are everywhere, including in places where people don't realize, many people, and I don't know, I don't dare to ask here, how many people are aware that, you know, two people in this room doing the same query on Google will get different answers. Okay, now the thing is, when you go to a news website, nowadays it's also personalized. The thing is, you know, when I buy a newspaper in the newsstand, I get a piece of paper, and I know it's the same that everybody who's bought that newspaper that day will get, right? So I have this model in my mind that the news is the news, or the, you know, the New York Times news is the New York Times news, and the Washington Post is the Washington Post. So, but I can go to their website, and I get some news, you get another set of news, and I'm not aware of it. Now, on top of that, of course, the recommendations are all personalized. So they have me, they encourage me, in a sense, to see more of the same. What I like when I read a newspaper or a magazine, which I these days only do in the plane because I get it for free when I get on the plane, is I run into things that I wouldn't read otherwise because it's not the kind of topics I'm normally interested in. But I flip through the pages and say, oh, this is interesting, and I'm stuck in the plane anyway. So, but online, these things happen less and less. You run into very few things that you don't expect. And Eli Pariser did this. It was not really a study, but he observed, and I think it was during a previous presidential election campaign in the U.S., he was noticing that, I don't remember if it was on Facebook, but probably it was, that the people that were being recommended to him or his network of person were more and more of the same political color, right? And so what he calls a filter bubble is because there is this ocean of information that, of course, we cannot, manage. It's being filtered for us, but in a way that is always consistent with our opinions, with our taste, etc. The effect this has is we imagine easily that our opinion are much more widespread than they are. Because if everything you see is consistent with your opinions, you're going to have the impression that everybody thinks like you. And I honestly think that a lot of the social unrest we've seen, including in France over the past year with the Gilets Jaunes and all that, and in other places in the world, and the rise politicians like Trump, etc., has been fueled not just by the manipulation that we all hear about, you know, whether the Russians or the whatevers, manipulating things, but simply people being themselves and being on Facebook and these social networks or on YouTube, etc., and always seeing the things that are filtered for you consistent with your opinions make you think that your opinion is dominant. This is coupled, of course, with the fact that political campaigns now have tools where they can also personalize the messages that are sent to voters. In fact, if you look historically, looking at the U.S. Campaigns, because that's more documented, if you look at the, I don't remember exactly the detail, but it went from messages that targeted sort of a large group of the population at once to targeting more smaller neighborhoods to, in the last instance, targeting individuals. So the message you're getting is different from the message your neighbor is getting, but they all think it's the same message because it comes from the party X or Y. And that shifts people's opinion in empowering them to think that their ideas are more widespread, which affects their behavior.
There are studies about that, cognitive studies about that. There's a bias. It's called confirmation bias.
Yeah, so there are many cognitive biases. Yes, and confirmation bias is exactly that. Yes, good.
It's basically that. You just trust what you think. What aligns with your opinion. You just trust it.
Yes, but I think what the thing that has changed is that the confirmation bias, existed before the internet and all that. because you were spontaneously going to ask people you trust, and you trust people because they think like you, and so this was happening in regular human-to-human communication. And now it's happening at the much larger scale in ways that you don't have control or are not aware of. So, but yeah, exactly. It's exactly a confirmation bias. Did I skip someone who wanted to say something? No? Yes? No? Okay, well, it will come back.
Because I was surprised, I didn't know this with Google, that the two people, because I always assumed that Google works on keywords and companies.
Oh, you didn't know that you don't get the same results as your neighbor?
Yeah, if we both Google for Fanta, we get something else. We didn't try it, but...
And now your trust in the world is shattered.
No, but I don't understand what... Because didn't Google work on keywords that I, as a company, I pay a lot of money for certain keywords?
Yeah, but that's combined with a whole bunch of other things. I mean, when it was using just PageRank, it's just the ranking of pages that count, then everybody doing the same query was getting the same answer. Now, the reason you are getting different answer than your neighbor for the same query is because they know it comes from you, because they put a cookie, so they know it comes from you, that you did these other queries in the past, and so that is another, what they call the signal, that is combined with the PageRank signal to re-rank the results. And yes, advertisers pay for certain keywords, but it's all, you know, one parameter in a bunch of mathematical formulas that decides on the final ranking. So, okay, well, you learned something today. the other thing that all these systems are in a sense supporting, for better or for worse, is this notion of surveillance. So, which was a word invented to mean the inverse of surveillance. So surveillance is when you have an authority, a government, police, that watches what you do, right? So there's a notion of, you know, they have more power than you, and they are entitled to be able to search your house or do this or do that. Surveillance is when you are being observed by your peers. So you don't even need the police. And so the fact that, you know, everybody is using their smartphone to take a shot of what's happening, you know, in the street, etc., and then they put it on the side and it becomes this big buzz, etc. And again, it's been very useful in some situations, but there's also a risk with it. And I think we are in a situation where the notion of, I don't know, this is going to be big words, but the notion of society, in a sense, is disaggregating. We learn to not trust anything or anyone anymore, that anything can be challenged, that anything can be criticized, and your social status, in a sense, can also be higher if you are seen as someone you know, a whistleblower or etc. Again, which can be sometimes extremely useful, but also has the other side effect that people are being bullied and being attacked, etc. For no good reason, because we're sort of instituted this notion where everybody can watch everybody else and have an opinion, have their opinion known to the rest of the world, and then other people are going to say, oh yes, this person is terrible, and etc. So I think this is really an era where there's massive changes in the way society itself is operating, I think it's important to be aware of it, again, so we can act and not be just passive. Finally, the risks and challenges are economical, because a lot of this thing we see happening is also driven by economical interests. And as I've said before, we are used to having services that are free, like Google, since we're talking about that. But as someone's put it, I don't know the original author of this quote, but on the internet, if you're not paying for something, you're not the customer, you're the product being sold, meaning it's your data that's being used instead of your money. And, well, I think I've talked about this enough already, but is this something we accept? Do we accept the risks that go with it, that we give too many information to people that then can use it against us? It's a political question, eventually. And as I mentioned when I was talking about crowdsourcing and all this, all these companies from Mechanical Turk to this more specialized one like Odesk, they create a form of work that has that has no contract, no social protection, and that changes the nature of work. Now, you can be like Michael Bernstein and say this is changing and we need to reinvent work in that new world. Yes, but when you say that from the position of a tenured professor at Stanford, I feel like, you know, maybe it's a little bit easy to say, hey, things are changing. I'm not going to lose my job, but that's not the question. Okay, to conclude, before we take a break, quick reminder that all these ideas have been anticipated in the 50s and 40s and even 30s by people like Vannevar Bush, Licklider, Doug Engelbart, that this notion of combining computers and human skills gives us more than the sum of the parts. However, they raise, and I think I've insisted enough on this, they raise technical issues, social issues, economical issues, ethical issues. But getting back to something I was saying earlier, they also raise the question of what it is to be human. Because our lives depend so much now on technology that the line between what we create and what the machine is doing get completely blurred. And especially these days where we hear time and again that, you know, AI is now better than humans at doing X, Y, and Z. So what's the end game here? You know, if the machine becomes better than us at everything, is that really a goal? I mean, to me, the goal of computers has always been to empower users so that I could do things that I could not do without a computer. The goal has not been that the computer could do things for me instead of me. Sometimes it's useful and convenient. I agree. I don't argue with that. But that's not the end game. The end game is that it should, if I'm a doctor, the computer should make me a better doctor, not turn me into a clerk that's doing the work that the computer cannot do, but is better at me at the expert things that I used to be an expert at. And I think a lot of the things that are done these days are de-skilling humans instead of upskilling them. And I think we could exactly use sometimes the exact same technique. I had an example from someone who is a researcher and created a startup that's using AI techniques and selling expert systems, as they were called at the time. And once they were contracted by the French Navy. And they were asked to make a system that would plan the route of the ship. Right, and so this company built this system, gave a demo to the Navy officers and etc. And they had the system that was doing, you know, this planning of the routes of the ship, which normally was done by people on the ship. And the officers look at this and says, "Oh no, that's terrible, because if we use this system, our soldiers, I don't know what you call them in the Navy, will not be able to do it anymore, so they will lose that skill." And so what the researchers or this company did, they came back and they changed their system so that it would not draw the route for the people in the ship, but it would ask the people to do what they used to do, which is to do it themselves, and then it would give recommendations, saying, "Well, here it's fine. Here you could, you know, try this, etc." So it was my point is that it was the same exact technology underneath, but the way it was presented to user was very different. In one case, it was, "I'm doing this for you. I'm putting it out of the loop." In the other case, I'm putting not only the human in the loop, which, as I've said before, is an expression I don't like, but I'm putting the computer in the loop of your human process. So you keep your skill, and maybe you can get even better at drawing these routes, which could also make the system even better at giving you recommendations and help. And I think that's an area where there's tremendous potential to build tools that make us better, not that do things for us. I think it's a nice way to close it. Yeah? Okay. Any questions? Okay, well, let's take a break. And after that, my idea was to do a little exercise for you guys to, you know, use your brain a little bit. Okay? Okay.